Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I always like to welcome you to the Tattered Cover Bookstore, and thanks for coming out this evening and supporting your local and independent businesses, because it really does make a difference. A couple things that are special about tonight's event, in addition to having our author, Willie Vallotton. How'd I do?
That was brilliant.
Yes. I was thinking about some of the characters that he talks about in his new book, The Free, where it seems like when they clock out of the one job, they seem like they then turn around and clock into the next job. And I was just asking him about... writing these amazing novels. This is his fourth novel, but also playing with his band Richmond Fontaine. Got it right too. And so that's something that I guess, and I just learned that they used to come through here quite a bit. I don't know, you haven't been here recently with that. So multi-talented person the lyricism works in both the prose that he writes about in books like tonight's book, The Free, but also comes across in the music. There's a great voice there that I know I'm enjoying reading it. I think everybody who has either picked it up already will enjoy it, or I mean, I know you will enjoy it. I don't have any, I guess there's without further, the other thing that I was going to mention is also Willie was going to be able to maybe play a couple songs for us tonight, which is a great addition to this event as well. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Willie Vallotton.
Thanks. Well, thanks for you guys showing up. I played on Colfax for years. We started at the Lion's Lair. And we were all excited because they said, we can't guarantee you money, but we'll give you a 12-pack of beer and pizza. And we're like, Jesus, that's better than any other place we play. And so we get there, and they have Tombstone Pizza, which if any of you high cuisine folks, it's frozen in their special Tombstone oven. The Tombstone gave them, of course, broke. And so they tried to heat it in this kind of other weird oven they had, and it was kind of all right. It was burnt and frozen at the same time, which is an interesting combination. And then, we moved up to a bar I can't remember that was worse than the Lion's Lair. And then we moved up to the 15th Street. Well, yeah, we did play the Larimer, too. Anyway, we went up and then we went down and then we went up again and then went down but Lion's Lair, I always remember, is when you start waking up in the middle of the night cursing yourself for all the bad decisions you've made. That's when I had a chance to be an electrician once. And that's playing gigs like at the Lion's Lair is when you wake up in the middle of the night and go, Jesus, I should have been an electrician. What am I thinking? But, in our first time through, I think, or second time through playing on Colfax, we had a major breakdown, and it was snowing, and we had to fix the van in the snow, me and one of the guys. And then we got snowed in once playing the Lion's Lair. So I guess that's why my third book, Lean on Pete, the kid ends up in Denver, and he ends up wandering around on Colfax, I guess because I used to wander around. And it's either really fun or it's really frightening, depending on who you run into. And depending on if you like bars or donut shops, and the kid in Lean on Pete likes his donuts, and I like the bars. So The Free is the hardest book I ever wrote. I did it pretty quickly in 6 months, and then I spent 3.5 years editing it. I was so worried about it. It has very, I think, pretty heated subjects, and it has a lot of moving parts. It has three characters. Each chapter is a different character, and there was no relief from it. It's a novel I first called A Letter to the Patron Saint of Nurses, based on a song I'd written. And I wrote it for the patron saint of nurses, a guy named Camilius de Lellis, in hopes that he would take notice of the characters in the book, maybe pay attention to them, the people that are like this, and look after them. And I wrote the book because of one night, really, or one day, I should say. I was a house painter for 12 years, and then luckily I quit being a house painter, and then I fell back on hard times again and had to go back to it. And 2 years later, and while I was gone, the clerk I saw 4 days a week or so had a baby. Him and his wife had a baby, and the kid was born with severe medical problems. And the guy was just kind of drowning in debt because of it. He had a pretty shaky health plan, and they needed to find specialists and go to different towns to find it. And he was going broke, and him and his wife were fighting all the time because of it. And he was a guy that worked at a paint store. I mean, there's no, he's not going to become vice president, you know, hit a big payday. He was stuck, and he knew he was stuck, and he didn't know what to do. And that's heartbreaking. And then on the way home, I stopped at a bar and had a drink, and on the news was a 2-minute segment on soldiers coming back with brain injuries. And it was a subject I'd followed since the beginning, and I have a friend that counsels guys with brain injuries, and it was a subject I just could never quite shake. And I thought the most horrific thing would be to make it back, but with a mind that was shattered in a lot of ways, where your emotions fluctuate and you can't control them. I thought one of the greatest fears I have, I guess, would be to be in a mind that you couldn't control at all. Maybe I fall in the soup, you know, or fall in the hole and get a dark mind once in a while, but I can always get myself out of it. But it would be scary if you couldn't control that at all. So that was another subject that was eating at me. And the last one was my girlfriend switched jobs. And she woke up 42 years old with a new job that didn't have a health insurance. And she couldn't get it. They wouldn't give it to her. We applied, and it's like applying for a credit card. You just sign up. There's no physicals, or you can't have a conversation with a doctor. She was just kind of blackballed, and it was the kind of thing that would wake me up in the middle of the night because she's my pal, you know. I worried about her. So really, this book, although I titled it A Letter to the Patron Saint of Nurses, it could be, you know, oh, shit, it's 3 in the morning, I can't sleep, and I'm worrying about everything. And so it is kind of my wake up at 3 a.m. book. So that's a little bit about The Free. The Free has three main characters. It has a soldier that comes who's just a National Guard electrician, actually. And he gets a brain injury, and he's spent the last 8 years in an adult group home. And then the other main character is a guy named Freddie McCall, who works at a paint store and then works at the group home at night. And then a post-operation nurse at a hospital named Pauline. And so I'll read a little bit about it so you get a feel. See if you think you want to make the endeavor into my semi-damaged mind. And I thank you guys for coming and supporting Tattered Cover, one of the amazing bookstores around, I would say. All right. Well, I better figure out what I'm going to do here. I'll start with I'm not going to do that. You guys seem too nice for me to send you down that road. I'll do a nicer segment. This is just to give you a feel of Pauline the nurse. Besides that, all the heavy stuff I was just saying, I've always had a thing for nurses. And I wanted to write, before I got run over by a truck or whatever, I wanted to write a story with a really cool nurse. And so I did. So if I get run over by a truck, at least I wrote about a pretty cool nurse. And this is just a small scene so you can see kind of what she's about. And it's also about a kid that's a street kid that Pauline ends up taking care of. Pauline was raised by a kind of a mentally unstable dad, and she spent her whole life building walls around herself. And this kid kind of just breaks through him because the kid reminds her of herself. "You're awake and you're back on my floor," Pauline said. "All good news for me. How you feeling, Joe?" "All right, I guess," the girl said. "Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your pain?" "4, Joe said. Pauline looked at her watch. "Well, I have a couple minutes and my feet hurt. Do you mind if I sit?" Joe shook her head. Pauline sat in the bedside chair. "Well, how was surgery?" "It wasn't that bad because they put me to sleep." "I told you it would go all right." "Well, I'm glad you told me." Pauline, I'm cutting out some swearing and some weird stuff, so if I ever pause, it's not because I can't read. It's because I'm trying to, any of you that are don't like swearing and get offended, it's too early in the night for me to offend you.
We probably wouldn't be here.
Really? Yeah, you're probably right, right? Yeah. Well, you never know. Some sucker might have gotten suckered into coming. All right. This is Pauline. "Hospital food isn't as bad as people say." "I know," the girl said. "Can I tell you something? For as rough as you've had it, you have a great skin. All the nurses talk about it." Joe tried to smile, but her face was sunken with worry. "Hey, you're going to be okay," Pauline said. "But what am I going to do now?" "You're going to get better." "But where am I going to go after that?" "You can worry about that when you get a little stronger." "But they're going to leave without me." Pauline looked out into the hall, saw it empty, and then turned to the girl and whispered, "They were going to let you get sicker and sicker until you died or lost your leg. You have to think about that, because it's true. As much as it hurts to hear, they don't care about you, Joe. They just don't. Look, I know you're alone, but you have to learn how to be all right alone. And if you don't, you'll end up in situations like you're in, and you don't deserve that." "But maybe I do deserve it," she said. "You really think so? Maybe. What have you done to deserve living in a freezing house with no water, with 3 junky boys who use you, who'd rather get a blowjob than help you get better?" "Well, I've been pregnant," Joe said quietly, and covered her face with her hands. "You have?" She nodded. "Well, what happened?" "I had an abortion," she whispered in tears. "Ah, hon," Pauline said, and set her hand on the girl's arm. Joe closed her eyes and turned her head away. "What about your family?" "I won't go back there." "You don't have an aunt or an uncle or a cousin you could stay with?" The girl just shook her head. "Well, those boys aren't going to end up anywhere good, believe me. I know, I've seen it. I see it here all the time. If you have to follow a man around, there's a lot better ones who try." The girl wiped her eyes and turned back to the nurse. "Do you have a husband?" "Me," Pauline said, and smiled. "No." "Well, why not?" "Well, I don't want one." "How about you? Do you want a husband?" "Me? Why would you ask me?" "We're having a conversation. If we're going to be friends, you ask me a question, and I answer it, and then I ask you one, and you answer it. That's how it works." "No one would want me because I'm a freak," the girl said. "You're not a freak, but I am. I've seen a lot of freaks, and you're not one. But I am," she said. "You're not. I win. End of discussion." Joe paused and cleared her throat and wiped her eyes again. "So why aren't you married? Why are you so worried about me being married?" "I'm not worried about it. I'm just asking." "I wanted to be once," Pauline said and got back up. "All right, let's take a look at those packings. I got to get back to work." "Who did you want to marry?" Pauline pulled the curtain around the bed and took back the blanket and sheet. "I lived with a guy when I got out of nursing school," she said. "I wanted to marry him." "Well, what was he like?" "He was all right at first," she said. "And then what happened?" "Well, he was always telling me what to do. That's one thing against him. I'd work all day and then go to my dad's house and make sure he was okay. And he'd tell me what to do. Then I'd go home and take care of my boyfriend. And he'd tell me what to do. And the only things my boyfriend liked were sports and hunting and drinking beer. He couldn't boil water. He could barely hold a job. But I loved him. I was crazy about him." "Really?" "Yeah. I kept asking him to marry me." "And he didn't want to marry you?" "No." Well, where is he now? He moved back to Spokane. He's been married and divorced twice and has kids from both women. He went bald and got fat, and he's always out of work. The last I heard, he was living with his brother. Pauline pulled back the bandages and looked at the packings. Hey, they look good. They did good work on you, Joe. I bet you'll be okay in no time if you start eating. The girl just looked at Pauline. Well, why did you want to marry him in the first place? Pauline pulled Joe's gown back down and covered her again with a sheet and blanket. Well, back then I wanted to be normal. That was my big dream. Some of the friends I'd made in nursing school were getting married and having kids. I wanted to be like them. And I wanted to admit that he needed me, that he couldn't live without me. I was young. Anyway, I did everything for him. I did his laundry and cooked, made sure he got up in the morning, made his lunch when he worked. I watched football with him and went to car and sports shows with him. And then I would spend days freaking out. She put her hand on Joe's arm and gently shook it. Do you need me? Do you need me? Do you want me forever? Do you want me for all time? I'd say things like that over and over. I'd say the stupidest thing. I was a mess and I put a lot of pressure on him. It drove him crazy. It would drive anybody crazy. So in the end, he left me. He really left you? Pauline nodded and pushed the curtain back out of the way. Was it awful when he left? For a while, I was so heartbroken I didn't know what to do. I just wanted to die. But after a while, it was okay. In the end, I was lucky to get out. He wasn't much of a man. I was just so scared of being alone and unloved that I would have married a tire if it would have asked me. Anyway, Joe, you don't have to do anything right now. Your only job is to start taking care of yourself. All right? I wish I was like you, the girl said. Pauline went to the computer and began entering her notes. That's the nicest thing anyone has ever said to me. Thank you. She looked at the girl and smiled. Okay, I have to get back to my other patients. I can't sit around all night having a good time. They fire nurses for that. And if you really want to be like me, eat. That's something I'm good at, even if they give you some sort of casserole. All right? All right, Joe said. So that just gives you a little flavor of Joe and Pauline. I'll read you one other section, and then I won't read you anymore, I swear. This is just a scene about Freddie McCall. He's the guy I told you about earlier that works at a paint store, and then he works at a group home at night. And he's working these two jobs because he's trying to... He's mortgaged his house twice, and he's losing a house that his grandfather gave him. And he's really ashamed of it. And Freddie, above all, is a hard-working, really kind of honest guy. But he gets so pushed against the wall, and he runs out of options to the point where an old co-worker of his asks him if he can grow weed in his basement. Because he knows Freddie lives in this big house now all by himself because his family's left. And Freddie agrees to it. But Freddie is not a criminal, and just the idea of it is making the little sleep he has disappear. He begins kind of crumbling under the idea that he's turning into a criminal. So this is just a little scene to give you a feel of Freddie and his predicament, I should say. At 6 the next morning, he left the group home and drove to his house. Even in the freezing cold, the smell of the plants drifted up from the basement. Would the smell travel? Would his neighbors smell it? He'd been avoiding them for almost 2 years since his wife and daughters left. What did they think of him now? And if they smelled the marijuana, would they know what it was? Mr. and Mrs. Hughes were old, and they didn't worry him, but the Jacksons were. Richard Jackson worked for the fire department. Maybe he suspected something already. He started a shower and turned on the box heater. He put his paint store clothes next to it, set the kitchen timer for 10 minutes, and got in. As he stood under the hot water, he looked at the old white shower tile and remembered his grandfather installing it. His grandfather always smoking cigarettes with greased back hair, making sure each line was straight. He'd been a perfectionist. It was his bathroom. It was his house. And now Freddie was losing it. He dressed and drove to Heaven's Door Donuts and parked. I always write about donut shops just because you know, you're sitting in a room by yourself on, you either want to eat donuts or get drunk, usually. And so I write about both. He walked inside to see Maura lean against a glass counter in red sweats and white apron. She was watching the news on a portable TV that sat on a shelf in the corner of the room. "Hey, you're 10 minutes early," she said. "Well, Dale was on time for a change," Freddie said. Maura moved her large body back and bent down and sighed from the effort. She took 5 donut holes from the lowest shelf, put them in a plastic basket, and set it in front of him. She poured him a 1/2 cup of coffee. Freddie drank from it and took an old hockey puck from his coat pocket and set it on the counter. "I was looking through some boxes last night, and I found this. It's from the 82 season when the Winterhawks won the WHL championship. I'm not sure what game it's from, but there's writing on it. It's my dad's handwriting. It says 82 Hawks. It's my after-Christmas present to you." Maura picked it up and flipped it over and read the writing. She grabbed his hand and squeezed it. "Thank you," she said. "Maybe it's from the championship game." "Maybe," he said. "Well, let's just say it is." "All right." She took her purse from the shelf below the register, put the puck inside, and leaned down on the counter again. "You really do look beat this morning, Freddie. It looks like you keep losing weight." "I know," he said, "but I'm okay." "Are you sure? Maybe you should go see a doctor." "I'm okay. Really, I am." He ate a donut hole and washed it down with coffee. "Did you get a chance to talk to your daughters last night?" "I did what you told me," he said, "and I wrote down a list of questions. That seemed to work better. We were on the phone twice as long that way, but you can tell they get bored. Kids have no attention spans. You know that." Freddie picked up another donut hole, but set it down. He looked at Maura, and suddenly tears flooded in his eyes. He couldn't explain why it happened right then, but he began to sob in front of her. "What's wrong, Freddie?" she asked. He stared at the rows of donuts below the glass counter. He leaned across and whispered, "I can't keep going like this." Maura reached over and put her hand on his arm. "I know," she said. "How could you?" "I'm sorry," he whispered and wiped his eyes. "Don't be sorry. It's okay," she told him. Tell me what's going on, Freddie." When he finally spoke, his voice was raw and so quiet it was barely audible. He couldn't even look at her when he spoke. "I keep making bad decisions. Why are all the decisions I make bad? I'm going to lose everything now. I know I'm going to lose everything." He wiped his eyes on his coat sleeves. "And I've failed everybody." "Ah, Freddie, don't say that. But it's true. It's not. You've known me here for, what, 13 years, right?" He nodded. "Think of all the nice things you've done for me. When Raymond left me, you'd come here in here every morning, and you could tell just by looking at me that I needed help. I didn't even have to say anything, and you'd invite me over for dinner. Your family took care of me, and you listened to me, Freddie, and no one listens to me. You made me want to keep going when I didn't want to keep going. So don't say you're a failure. You've never failed me, Freddie." She walked out from behind the counter and went to him and put her arms around him. She smelled of donuts and soap, and she was soft and warm. And he collapsed into her and closed his eyes as 2 white work vans pulled in front of the donut shop with their headlights shining in on them. So those are just 2 sections, and that's probably enough reading for you guys, so I don't want to put you to sleep this early in the night. But the one thing that is kind of consistent with all the books is they all started as songs. And so I'll play maybe a couple of songs that inspired The Free. My first novel, The Motel Life, started as songs. And Northline became, I wrote a soundtrack for that book and wrote 12 songs for that sad girl in that book. And then Lean on Pete started as a song called Laramie, Wyoming, and then turned into a song that was an 8-minute folk song with no chorus and no hook, and was so depressing it made my girlfriend cry, but not in the cry of, it was so beautiful, you blew my mind. It was just like, Jesus, I can't believe I'm living with this sad sack. So I'll play you just a few songs, and then we'll take it from there. This is a song I wrote for the guy Freddie McCall, the guy I just read about. And I wrote this two or three years before I started the book. And in this version, he's taking care of his mom. And it wasn't his daughter's. And it was him growing the weed. But you can see just kind of how it starts. It's an angry little folk song. He was 43 years old, paying for his mother to be in a home, paying his ex-wife and kids in a different state. He worked at a paint store. He mortgaged his home. He was going broke. He was going broke. He started growing weed, 40 plants and more. The home got off his back, so did the ex-wife, even though she was living with a cop. Get drunk and he wouldn't leave her alone. She started calling, begging for more money so she could get out on her own. So she could get out on her own. Well, the road it goes on, and there ain't no choice. The cop broke her jaw, so his kids moved back home. His mom's rotting in the center, and the bills, they never leave him alone. Keeps a lock on his basement door, and he sweats it out alone. And in the evening, he hears the sirens and the helicopters roll. And he knows it's gonna, oh, he knows it's gonna, he knows it's gonna, oh, he knows it's gonna hit. Thank you very much. So while I was writing on the free, one of the guys in the band I'm in married a Danish woman and moved to Denmark. And so we kind of just stopped playing for almost 2 years, I think, a year and a half. And so I thought, Jesus, this will be the time. The last tour my band did, we toured with this woman joined the band, and she's got a great kind of like Dusty Springfield if she was just a little raw and more raggy. She's got a really beautiful voice, I think. And she got drunk one night, and she says, Will, write me a record. And so I was like, Jesus, wouldn't it be fun to write songs for somebody that could really sing, which has always been the dream. And I was like, maybe I can just hide in the back, like behind the drummer in the dark, but be in the band still and do all the work, which is, I like the work part of being in a band. And so I wrote her a bunch of songs, and one of the songs I wrote her, surprisingly, is called Colfax Avenue. I guess I was still thinking about that, but I was thinking about the soldier Leroy. And this is taken from a point of view of a sister whose brother comes back from from war, and he's a mess. And so this is a song I wrote for her, and we have a new band that we'll start touring called the DeLines. But I apologize if I can't hit the notes, but just think of a really cool woman singing this. Don't think of me dressed as a woman. I gave that up 6 months ago. I got woken up late last night by a friend of his. Said he left the lion's lair with a bloody head. He could hardly walk, just disappeared. My husband's asleep, my kids are in bed. I'll even know and start driving up and down I stop by the alleys in the liquor stores, and the bars, they still let him into. He wasn't like this before he left. Now he comes back and his mind's a wreck. And the army, oh, what do they do? My husband's worn out. My kids are scared. But he's my little brother, and he's out there somewhere. Up and down, up and down the Colfax Avenue. The nights can be so long, and it's so cold outside. He's just a kid who's seen too much. He's just a kid up and down. Colfax So the last song I'll play is for I wrote for Charlie Thompson, the kid in Lean on Pete. I really liked that kid. He got me out of bed for 2 years because he was so resilient. He would just get beat up almost every day by something, and he would always get back up on his feet. And I needed to be around a guy like that, or find that part of me again. But again, I guess he ends up mowing lawns in this area. And I'm not really sure why I brought him here, but I thought this would be the place that he would end up for at least a couple weeks. So I'll just play this one. It's called The Kid from Belmont Street. And Belmont Street's what kind of where I used to live, off Belmont Street. Just a mixed up kid. Well, I know, 'cause I've been there too. But you don't know what it means to get into a car. People you don't know, just stay here. You fit in somewhere, someone. You just have to wait it out. Cause you don't know what it means to not trust anyone. It'll haunt you. It'll destroy you. or just a mixed up kid? Well, I know, but I will help you out. I'll get you out of this. If anyone has any questions or anything, I'll stand back up and hide back here. If anyone does have any questions about the books or anything else, I can give advice on any subject. I just wouldn't trust any of it.
Is your band coming back to Denver sometime?
Not for a while. You know, Richard Fontaine's just making a record right now, and the DeLines bands. We're touring in Europe this spring, but I don't know when we're going to be doing a U.S. thing. So I don't know. We'll see. But everybody's good, and we're working on a record, so we'll keep going. We'll be back to the Lions, Larry, and Tombstone Pizza if they'll have us.
I know the Retro Soul for Northline. Do you know if that's ever going to be made?
Into a movie?
Yeah.
The question was if Northline, my second book, could be made in a movie. You know, it was almost made, and then they had the actress and the funding and all that, and then it just disappeared. The only thing I've ever learned about that stuff is they're Ivy League used car salesmen. They're really good at it, and they get you all excited, and then they just disappear, or you buy the car and it doesn't start. So I don't really pay attention, you know. I'm a big movie fan, but I'm realistic about my intelligence and the way I could navigate that world, and I know I'd get beat up and run over. So I stay away. I run the other direction. But I know Lean on Pete's looking like they're going to make a movie out of that one, and I really like the guy that's running that. So we'll see. If he gets lucky, maybe they'll make it. I don't know. Thanks for asking. Northline's my favorite one. All right. Yeah, I really like that girl. She's really rough and a wreck. I wrote her based on my mom and me and my grandmother. The alcoholic part of the girl was me, not my mom or grandma. I don't want to do that to them. But I really like that girl. She broke my heart. You know, I wrote... It's a short novel, maybe 200 pages, and I wrote... maybe 200 pages more for where she goes to college and, you know, has a really easy run. And then I go, she just wouldn't do that. And I cut all the nasty scenes out of that book. And then I said, well, she would do those things. And I don't want her to have to go through it, but that's the kind of thing, whether it's that exact thing I put in there or something just like it. So I had to put it all back in. But I almost didn't publish that book because I didn't want to admit that girl had to go through all those things, but I thought she did. So, if that makes any sense at all?
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, that's good. It made sense to me, but a lot of things I think make sense to me.
It was so much hope at the end, you know? I mean, it just
makes
you, like, just so hopeful.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing about that girl is she, when somebody's nice to her, she hangs on to them. A lot of people get scared when they're around people that are nice or kind to them. It makes them uncomfortable if they've had a rough run. But she's not like that. And so I think as many dents as she has and will have the rest of her life, I think she's got that go for. And I think at the root, I think some people are resilient and can kind of duct tape themselves back together, and some people can't. And she's one that I think can. So we'll see. Right. Any more?
Sure. I guess you said you worked at painting houses for a long time.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if you have any advice for how to do what you're doing and, like, make a living and at the same time move towards.
I mean, I'm not the best example, but because house painting really was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And that's usually what guys do when they're either on the drug addiction decline or it's what they do when they get out of prison. No offense to any paint contractors here. But, you know, for me, I've worked in warehouses my whole life. You know, I worked for trucking companies and warehouses. And then a friend of mine, I came back from a tour and I'd quit a job for like a really good trucking company to go on this tour. And I didn't know what to do afterwards. So a friend of mine was a house painter and I helped him. And then, and it was just the best money I ever made. And then when I went out on my own, I could start at noon and then tell the lady whose house I was supposed to be working on, I'd say, well, I had another bid, you know, or I was doing a, you know, a consultation when really I was just home writing stories. And I, you know, I remember for years trying to get, like, I worked for this trucking company, this old guy, and I was begging him that I could do the same work in 4 days that he had me do in five. And I said, you don't have to pay me more. I just need the extra day off so I can write. And I got tired of quitting jobs I'd always quit jobs to write the first draft of something. So I'd feel strong about it before I went back to work. I'd have something. And, you just get a hard time in jobs like that. For wanting less hours, everybody wants more hours. And so I never was very good at navigating it. I mean, there's a lot of jobs like bartending there's a lot of jobs you can make money and not work a ton of hours. It was house painting. It took me till I was 34 to figure that out. And I was just miserable working jobs from, 18 to 30. I think I started painting when I was 32 or 33. So I don't know. The best advice is get up before you go to work, like at 5 or whatever, and right then, because you save your best brain for yourself. I used to drink Hansen's energy drink, like before Red Bull, and I would just drink two of those from 5. And I was an alcoholic too, so I was always hungover. And then I would sit there in front of the computer and 3 days a week, and maybe one of those days I'd actually get something done. The rest of the days I'd just be like, oh my God, I'm tired. Oh my God, I'm tired. So, but if you keep slogging it out, maybe you'll figure out a way, your way. So everything I said, don't do any of the things I said. You seem a lot healthier than me. So, yeah.
Did you always have to be able to give, let me start again. It's amazing the books that you write and the music that you create. Did you always have that need to get that out into the world?
The question was, did I always have the need to put this stuff out in the world? No, not put it out in the world. I mean, I wrote novels from 20 to maybe 35 without showing them to anybody, really. Just a few friends here and there or whatever. But I liked it so much, the craft of it, that I was scared that if I realized I was no good at it, then I wouldn't want to do it anymore. No one likes to do what they're not good at. But really, I just wanted to be in a band that had a flyer, you know, on a telephone pole, just to be one of the bands listed. And then my ambition got to where I wanted a van. Like, I used to just dream about parking the van in front of the club, and it didn't matter what year the van was, you know. So one of the only real gifts I have is I'm really pragmatic. And I'm realistic, you know, and so those were my dreams. And then I was like, Jesus, wouldn't it be good to, you know, but I have a little ambition in there. I was like, Jesus, wouldn't it be great to be in a record store, like have your records with all the other records? Wouldn't it be great to have your book in a library or bookstore? And by the time I was 35, I wanted one of my books to be in a bookstore or library more than I was scared that I was a failure at it. So I took a chance, but, you know. But I never had the ambition to show people it or get up in front of people as much. I mean, I've been doing this for more than half my life, and I still had to go across the street and have a couple drinks just to get in front of you guys. But I did have a desire to be a part of it, to be in that club that likes that sort of stuff that ruins your life, you know, rock and roll and writing novels. Yeah. All right, I could one more question if you got one or not.
Keeping your house painting skills.
I just sold one of the biggest things I just did. I had a white, painting truck and it had 200,000 miles on it. I sold it and I really And I was like, Jesus, I'm just going to get, it'll be like 3 more years and I'll have to go back. But I haven't sold any of my stuff, but I hope to God never to do that. It's like I used to drive by warehouses and I would tear up just going, I'm never going back. And now I see a guy in paint clothes and I just get like, it's like seeing your ex-girlfriend make out with a guy. It just doesn't feel right. So thanks for making me think about that. And then, did you have one?
Oh, yeah. I was wondering if in your writing you ever find that you stop because you think you're writing a song instead. Think you're writing lyrics to a song.
You know, the thing with writing fiction is it's... you know, the way I write songs, and sadly, I've always written songs from a certain side of me, like a more emotion. Like when I look like hell, and you're going, Jesus, like what happened to him? It's usually because something did happen, and I'm writing, and then I write songs because I only write songs when I'm really kind of dark or depressed, you know, or like your girlfriend throws something, you know, hits you in the head with a coffee mug and yells at you. And then I write a song, you know. That's the way it is, or that sort of stuff. So, but, you know, writing novels takes years, man. So you go through a lot of those stages in 3 years or whatever. And then I worry about, I mean, I'm kind of crazy, but I worry about, like, Pauline and Freddie and the Free. I wrote them to remind me to remember to be kind and try to be, never be bitter, you know, that side of you that... that always comes out, and everybody's got to come to terms with how to continue to be kind and not cynical. And I wrote those characters to help remind me of that and tag me along, and so I would be thinking about those kind of themes for whatever, 3 years. So I write a lot of songs based on those emotions. So the songs and the stories, thematically, they all live in the same apartment building. It's just... You know, they're just different people inside that building. You know what I mean? If that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I can sign books here, and if you got any private questions, I'll be sitting near the throne to sign books. I really appreciate you guys coming out and supporting Tattered Cover and me, and I appreciate it a lot. Seriously, so thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.